Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and we're getting cultural on this episode of the show with a playwright. Now, everybody who has listened to this show for the past 3 years knows that I'm partial to theater, that I love live stage stuff, musicals and plays, more than pretty much anything else. And so it's always a pleasure and an honor to talk to someone who does the craft with particular skill and particular taste and longevity. And that definitely goes for my guest in the neighborhood. His name is Jeffrey Sweet, and he is a theater critic, a playwright. He's also written for television, and he's doing a bunch of stuff all the time, but a lot of things seem to be happening specifically now with his work. So it's a good time. Also, this being that in-between time from the announcement of the Tony nominations to the Tonys, second week of June. So there's no better time for us to be talking to Jeffrey Sweet. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Good, good. I'm busy, but I doubt I'm as busy as you are. Why don't you tell the folks what's going on?
Well, I've got a busy season coming up, which is darn nice. I have a play called The Value of Names, which I actually wrote back in 1983, and all of a sudden, within the last 3 or 4 years, this play is getting done all the time. And it caught the particular interest of Jack Klugman, who has been very attracted to the lead part, and he first did it a few years ago, and then he said, I want to do it again, so he led a tour last year, a tour of 3 theaters, and then he said, I want to do it again, so he's going to be doing it at the George Street Playhouse in November. So looking forward to that.
George Street's in New Jersey, right?
Yeah, in New Brunswick.
And
it's where Rutgers University is.
Oh,
David Saint runs it. It's a Lort Theater and quite a good one. So I'm very pleased. The funny thing is that I still haven't been officially informed of this by the theater. I found this out from a news story and then went to the website and saw that the website had announced that the play was being put on. So I mean, they've contacted Dramatist Play Service. They're the people who license the play, but I haven't been officially informed of this, so I'm sort of amused. One of the values of the internet is to find out what's happening to you.
Tell people, though, about The Value of Names. What is the play concern?
Well, the play is about a man named Benny Silverman, who was blacklisted back in the 50s when a guy who had previously been his best friend, Leo Gresham, had been called in front of the House Un-American Activities Committee, and Leo, in order to get clear with HUAC, had named Benny's name, and Benny had then been blacklisted, and obviously the two guys have not talked since. This was, from Benny's point of view, a major betrayal.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, the play takes place in the early 80s, and Benny's daughter, who is a young actress, has been cast in a play that's trying out in Los Angeles, so she's come to stay with her father. Her father, in the meantime, has made something of a comeback. The blacklist went out of effect. He got a part playing a crazy neighbor on a situation comedy, made oodles of money, retired, spent most of his time on a patio painting very bad paintings, and generally having a fine time. He's delighted that his daughter's coming to stay with him while she's rehearsing a play. But in the middle of the rehearsals of the play, their director takes sick. And the producers decide to bring in a new director. And the new director is Leo, the guy who played her father.
Mm-hmm.
So it sets up the question of how is she going to deal with this? Is she going to work with this man who, by something he did back in the 50s, did severe damage to her father's career? Leo, realizing that Benny's daughter is in the show and that she's considering dropping out, uses this as an excuse to drop in uninvited. And it sets up a big climactic scene.
Don't tell folks how it turns out. But,
I'm not going to tell you how it turns out. There'd be no suspense in that then. But it's a big, it builds to this big actor's duel between the two guys. And over the years, I've had the pleasure of seeing a lot of interesting actors do it. There was a radio version of it that Gary Marshall did with Hector Elizondo. It was great fun because, of course, they've worked together for years, so they had all that stuff to draw on. There was a version which I didn't get to see where the late Howard Morris, who was the short guy on
your show.
Show,
yeah,
did it with Ed Asner.
Hmm.
Shelley Berman played Benny in Chicago in a fairly long run. right now people are talking about the blacklist again, and I think that a lot of it has to do with what's happening in D.C. I think that we're back in times that the people who went through the McCarthy era find kind of reminiscent of those days. You know, a place we're in a situation where government is intruding on people's private beliefs. We're in a time when people are illegally using agencies to collect private information. We're in a time when when the administration is claiming that anybody who opposes their policies is unpatriotic and perhaps even a traitor. Hmm. So we're in a terrifically polarized time. I'm hard pressed to think of any reason why I would want to thank George Bush for anything, but I think he's certainly had a lot to do with getting this play up and going again, and it's just popped up again, and I don't think it's just that people have suddenly recognized, oh, look, here's a modern classic. I'd like to think that, but I don't think it's true. Something interesting happened. There was a little production up in Stratford, Connecticut not too long ago, and I went up to see it, and I was happy with the production, and afterwards I was talking to the audience. And a woman in the audience got up and she said, you would have no way of knowing this, but you just put my life on the stage. And it turned out that her father had been, his name was Bob Roberts, and he had been John Garfield's producer. He had produced two or three of John Garfield's best movies. And Garfield and her father had been blacklisted. And her father had gone to England to get away from the blacklist. But he had never talked very much about what had happened to him. And finally, you know, she tried to find out what made the family leave the States and go to England, move to England. And finally, her father told her this story about being blacklisted. But the father had never worked as a producer again. And so this is, to a large degree, a play about this woman who is discovering what her father went through politically. You know, because we're affected by things whether we know, we're affected by our parents whether we know what they've been through or not.
Well, actually, then let's roll that back a bit and go to your childhood, Jeffrey Sweet.
Oh, good Lord.
And well, see what formed the building blocks that made you a playwright.
Well, one of the things is that my dad always wanted to be a novelist himself. He had several degrees in history, so he wanted to teach, and one day when he finally got a class and discovered that he really didn't have a talent for teaching, he couldn't convey his passion for his subject matter to a group of undergraduates at UCLA, and he realized that he just wasn't a teacher, so he switched over to writing PR for universities, first Northwestern University and then the University of Chicago. But he always wanted to write, and instead of writing, he earned money to keep me in clean jammies. I don't know, you know, he took care of the family.
Right.
So on that side, I had a father who was a is a writer,
mm-hmm.
you know, although what he did was write PR stuff, but he always wanted to be a novelist. And then on my mother's side, my mom is a classically trained violinist who came out of Juilliard.
Oh.
And she had played in the pit orchestras on Broadway at Radio City Music Hall. She was in Frank Sinatra's string section when he was when he played the Paramount, you know, and she, so for her, music was her life.
Did she have any great Sinatra stories? Any anecdotes about him?
Well, she said that when she knew him, he was very nice, that he made a point of taking every single member of the orchestra out to dinner. And So one night he took her out to dinner, and it was during wartime, and he had managed to pull his connections to get nylons for all the women in the orchestra. And she said that, you know, she all these stories that she heard about Sinatra's subsequent bad behavior bears no relationship to the guy she knew, who she thought treated people very well. She had nothing but nice things to say about him and about the way he treated the orchestra.
Well, the strange part was that he bought nylons for the men too. I very weird kind of situation there, but we'll get into that.
Well, I mean, there has to be some reason why those guys weren't in the army, but never mind.
But okay, so you had that background of parents who were creative, who were artistically bent. That didn't mean, sometimes that would mean the child would go in the opposite direction.
Well, actually, my mom, having gone through that life, did not want me to do this at all.
Hmm.
It was something of a battle. You know, she wanted, you know, both my parents are children of the Depression, and safety and security were, you know, things that they placed a high premium on. So she wanted me to go off and become an actuary or something. She said, you've never heard of a starving actuary. And I said, you've never heard of an actuary. But finally, she sort of relented. You know, this is what I was going to do. I knew from about age 13 I was going to be a playwright. She relented, and then, you know, I started getting produced at a very young age. I was still in college when I had my first professional production.
What show?
It was a musical. I wrote book, music, and lyrics to something called Winging It, which was a very loose adaptation of Aristophanes' The Birds that was done as a special project at the Milwaukee Rep back in, good Lord, what was it, 1970.
Wow.
So I was 20 years old, and the school gave me a few weeks off to go to Milwaukee,
mm-hmm.
where I froze my tuchus, and we put up the show.
Well, you're from Chicago. I mean, come on. It's a rather cold city, too.
Yeah, but the Milwaukee Rep was built in a kind of a compound with a lot of cement, and I remember it as being one of the coldest times I've ever been. In Chicago, there's some buildings you can hide behind, and this place in Milwaukee, it was like picture the same school of architecture as the UN, and imagine hit by a blast of cold air from Lake Michigan and sliding across ice covered slabs of concrete.
But you were probably too excited to care, or you were just kept warm by the fact that, oh my God, they're doing my musical.
Well, that was considerable compensation. You know, I do an awful lot of work in Chicago, and frequently I do the work in some very bad weather. In fact, the first time I had a show put up in Chicago was in the middle of, I think it was the worst blizzard there in 30 or 40 years. I arrived, the place was filled with snowdrifts 6 to 10 feet tall, which had frozen, and people...
That's Chicago cement.
people lost their cars for months, literally.
Wow.
And worst blizzard in years. You know, it would snow, it would melt a little bit, then it would freeze, it would snow, melt a little bit, and freeze, and the cycle kept going until there was a point where you would be walking down the street, you'd be walking on a sidewalk, and to one side of you would be a building, and to the other side would be frequently a 10-foot-tall solid wall of frozen snow and ice, dirty. So you'd be walking down corridors, and only at intersections could you see the rest of the street. And so I arrived in this. I had my first show in Chicago was just about to open. I arrived in this, and I went to the rehearsal, and they were doing a gorgeous job. And I thought, well, this is a beautiful production. Too bad nobody's going to come and see it. Who's going to be so nuts to brave this weather? And it opened. It got a terrific review from the Chicago Tribune, and we sold out the run in 3 days.
Wow.
And I thought, okay, Chicagoans are tough. Nothing's going to get in the way, get between them and a play they want to see.
And it's true, because we both know critics from Chicago. You've also been a theater critic.
I have, yes.
So you know, belonging to some of the organizations that we do, some of the Chicago people, and they've been at it for, they're not that old, and they've been doing it for 30 or 40 years.
Yeah.
And, they will see everything and anything.
Oh, it was a great community. I had the good fortune of coming in there at a time when Richard Christensen was at his peak, and Linda Weiner was still writing in Chicago.
She's at Newsday now, of course.
She's at Newsday now, yeah. For my money, one of the best critics writing in the New York area, easily.
What makes her so good?
She is able to write a pan without making the people she's panning want to go out and kill themselves for her. she's in sympathy with what you're attempting to do, even if she has reservations about how it's turned out. So you always get the feeling, even if she isn't enthusiastic about what you've done, that she has sympathy with the struggle. She also had an extraordinary column which she ran for years on Sundays, in which she chronicled the culture wars. Back before she and I became friendly, she would review me, and those reviews were not always good. I always appreciated the craft of her work. And then we subsequently became friends, and she says, I can't review you anymore. So I said, that's okay. Friendships, that's fine. So when I open stuff, she sends second stringers from Newsday. And that's how she gets around that. Christensen had an interesting thing in that he indeed was friendly with and knew virtually everybody in the Chicago theater scene. But you just took his integrity for granted and knew that if he didn't like what you did, he would say so. But again, there was no malice in what he said. And he discovered half the people that we think of as being part of the Chicago theater boom. He found Robert Falls when he was working non-equity theater.
Mm-hmm.
He found the Steppenwolf Gang when they were non-equity working in a suburb, the basement of a church in a suburb. There was a play that opened that got terrible reviews from absolutely everybody else. And he published a review that says, you know, I respectfully disagree with my colleagues. I think this is not only an important play, but this is the beginning of a major career in American theater. And the play was America Buffalo. He saved America Buffalo, which is one of the reasons why in the litany of critics, David Mamet has consigned to hell. Richard is never in that list.
Are there any critics that you have consigned to the underworld?
Oh, some of them are still out there, and I'm going to end up being reviewed by some of them. But anybody who's written a gratuitously nasty review, and I'm glad to say that there aren't very many of them, but there's a woman in the Chicago Sun-Times named Hetty Weiss.
And oh, yeah.
I'm not alone in thinking that she shouldn't have that job, but I share that feeling with Tony Kushner and Joe Mantello, who have been so outraged by stuff that she has written that they've demanded and gotten space in the Chicago Sun-Times.
Wow.
Calling her down for particularly stupid and insulting and ill-informed things that she's written. So she knows that I'm not fond of her, and I suspect she's not fond of me.
And Dave Lefkowitz is here for the play-by-play. The play-by-play-by-play by Dave in his book of plays, Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World. Comedies, satirical, silly, sad, and strange, all collected in a great-looking book. Just $20 hardcover, $12 soft. Email davesdongby at AOL.com or visit davesdongby.org for Marriage, Babies, and the End of the World. Da-da-da-da-da-da! Play Dave!
Hi, my name is Jeff Sweet. I'm the playwright of The Value of Names and the author of Something Wonderful Right Away. And I am here with Days Gone By on WGBB.
We are talking with Jeff Sweet, playwright and critic and a very busy fella. And I want to know, Jeff, what your day, as it were, is like as a working playwright and writer. I mean, it is your full-time gig. You're not one of those youngish playwrights who is waiting tables or doing all sorts of other stuff and then finding time, as Tennessee Williams once did, to write poems on a shoebox. I mean, this is your gig, and it's been...
Well,
yeah.
Things that are associated with writing, I mean, I do a fair amount of teaching. I'm spending a lot of this summer running around teaching workshops. I'm going off to Alaska shortly, and after Alaska I'll teach in Seattle, and after that I'll come back and teach a seminar at the O'Neill Center. And then I'm going to be teaching for something called the Summer Improv Retreat, because I'm very interested in improvisational theater and sometimes develop material improvisationally. You know, I wrote a book about Second City called Something Wonderful Right Away.
Yeah.
And writing that book taught me more about writing. Writing about improvisation taught me more about writing at my keyboard than anything else. Because a lot of the same theories that support improvisational scene development can be adapted into writing theories.
Such as?
Well, such as keeping things in the present tense, eschewing adjectives, making certain that characters have objectives, not articulating the objectives or the most important word, but having the audience figure out what those things must be through the way characters behave. The importance of putting charged objects on stage, that sometimes if you put the right object on stage through the way the characters deal with an object, you can get across everything you need to know about the politics of the relationship without people explaining a word.
Is there a play that you can point to with a very specific, useful example of that?
Oh, sure. The beginning of the third act of The Odd Couple, when Oscar and Felix aren't talking to each other, and Felix comes out with a plate of pasta, and Oscar picks up an air freshener and goes marching around the room, spraying the room, and then sprays Felix's pasta. And he says, "There, I hope you like that on your spaghetti." And Felix says, "Ha, ha, ha." And Oscar says, "What you saying ha, ha, ha about?" And Felix says, "That ain't spaghetti, that's linguine." And then Oscar picks up the plate and hurls it against the kitchen wall and says, well, now it's garbage. And Felix says, I'm not cleaning that up. And Oscar says, don't. And Felix says, it's just going to hang there on the wall, and it's going to harden, get yucky, and attract cockroaches. I'm going to clean that up. And Oscar says, if you touch one strand of whatever the hell that is, I'll break your head. Well, now, you notice that they have said nothing explicitly about how they feel about each other. They've just been dealing with the object. But by the end of that, you know,
yeah,
there's tension in that room. So it's entirely through negotiation over objects. But it isn't just specific to Neil Simon. Shakespeare does it brilliantly. And if you take a look at the second scene in Streetcar Named Desire, the trunk scene, all of the exposition that's necessary is done through the way Stanley handles items out of Blanche's trunk. Just the fact that he opens the trunk without her permission, prefigures what's going to happen later, because that in itself is a kind of violation, a kind of rape. So these are techniques that can be taught. I mean, these are techniques that I articulate. You know, I wrote two books on playwriting, the better known of which is called The Dramatist's Toolkit, and these are techniques that you can use either improvising or writing plays or screenplays. So I'll go off to this place in the Catskills with three or four other people from the improv world, somebody from Second City, somebody from the Groundlings, a few other people, and I. We take over a hotel, and for a week, whoever shows up, we teach this stuff to, and we have rigorous admission standards. You cannot get into this program unless your check clears.
Well, how much is it? Because I'm getting my pen out now.
There are two fees. One is the fee for the instructors, which is in the neighborhood of $500. And then the other fee is goes to the hotel, depending on whether you want to, have a single room with a bathroom in the room, or whether you want to pitch a tent or live in a yurt. I'm too old to live in a yurt. I'm sorry.
I'm too poor to live in anything but a yurt. Yeah.
That also includes food, and the food actually at this joint is quite good. This is we've been doing this for something like 12 years, but the outfit that sponsors it is called Artistic New Directions, and if people toss Artistic New Directions and Summer Improv Retreat into Google, they'll get there. We're going to be doing it July 30th through August 4th. So it's Sunday, July 30th through August 4th.
Have you worked with some well-known people and coached them, and then they've gone on to Broadway success or regional success?
Oh, yeah. No, I've been running workshops or setting up workshops for a long time. Years ago, I founded something called the New York Writers Block, and the alumni from the Writers Block, I'm not saying, mind you, that I taught all these people, but I created the circumstances under which we taught each other. But Donald Margulies started Writing Sight Unseen in that group. Winnie Holtzman, who wrote Wicked, was in our group.
That's a brilliant book, yeah.
Jane Anderson, who wrote
The Baby Dance.
The Baby Dance, and is now writing and directing films. Keith Gordon, who's a leading independent film director. Also, Jerry Stiller and Ann Mira were in the group, and Ann started writing plays in that group. So that was kind of a good group.
But then, yeah.
At one point I had an ad for teaching in some trade organization, I don't know, whatever it was, trade paper, and Warren Light took me aside and said, well, why did you put in that I was one of your students? I didn't want to admit that I'd forgotten that he'd been one of my students. But, he says, Tony Award-winning playwright, endorses Jeffrey's pizza. That gets you some students. Well, he's right, I suppose.
Well, Warren's a real promoter of I got an email from him a couple of weeks ago before, I think, the Drama Desk nominations were, or when the Drama Desk nominations were announced, but before the award winners were announced. And he was mentioning his play, No Foreigners Beyond This Point.
Well, that was a terrific play.
It was very good. But it was weird to get, like, a real self-promoting sort of thing from, look, I'll send you the script if you want to read it, if you didn't get to see it, or if you want to remember it.
Yeah.
I'm up there, please vote for me. I was like, whoa, that's ballsy.
Well, part of the problem is that unless you've got a big budget, some of these shows, it's very difficult to get attention. I had a show off-Broadway in the spring called Bluff. Got a sensational review out of Newsday. Got quite a good review out of the New York Times. But, if you do something off-Broadway, you've got only 16 performances, and it's difficult to get all the people there you want to have get there. So you know, most of the members of the drama desk did not get to see my show. I knew I didn't have a chance at a nomination for any of those awards because most of them just weren't going to get there in those 16 performances.
And you've had your share of heartbreaks, I'm sure, or I know, with producers, with producer who options the piece or says, okay, yes, I'm going to get this done, I've got the money, or I've got three-quarters of the money.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but that happens to everybody in the business. I had one show called Flyovers that was under option, and we almost had our money, and then September 11th happened, and all of a sudden most of the money disappeared because those people couldn't imagine that anybody would ever want to go to the theater in New York ever again. That play will get done. It just won't get done by that producer.
And you also mentioned that the people that you have worked with in those workshops went on to do a lot of film work. And I'm interested to see whether you have or whether that's a direction you've chosen not to go. Because you figure a person who's had one or two really well-reviewed plays, even if they're not big Broadway hits, is probably going to end up going to California for where the money is and write movies.
Well, I've done my share of writing for television, including some TV movies. I wrote the shooting script for Pack of Lies, the Hallmark Hall of Fame adaptation of Hugh Whitmore's play, and that was really substantially my script. And so I felt very pleased when it won the Peabody Award, even though I was listed as a creative consultant. But if you see the name creative consultant, that means that that's the person who came in and rewrote the script. And I wrote chunks of other TV movies and a fair amount of, I've done enough TV writing that I actually have my pension vested through the WGA.
Nice.
So I'm...
And you did soap opera work, which you were never disparaging about. I thought that was really cool.
Well, there's a technical challenge there. There's no reason that you can't make your writing for a soap opera be as good as your writing for anything else. In fact, some of what I learned was, you had to keep turning it out and had to be... For my sake, I didn't want anything to come out that wasn't good. So I had to learn how to write good stuff even if I wasn't in the mood. You know, a lot of writers just sort of sit around and say, am I inspired today? And if they aren't inspired, why, they go do something else. But when you're on staff and you have to turn out stuff, and when you take pride in anything that your name is on, you've got to learn how to write well even if you're not inspired to do so. And that's where craft comes in. That's where technique comes in. It's like you can't get the car started by putting the key in the ignition, so you start pushing it and you pop the clutch, and you just try to figure out another way to get the car started. So what happened was that working on the soap opera, I learned how to get myself started and to write at a certain level even if I at the beginning I wasn't in a great mood to do so. And in fact, it was one year when I was writing soap opera, I was in the facing a divorce that I was very unhappy about, and I wasn't in the mood to do much of anything except jump in front of a subway train. But I wasn't about to do that, and I had to make a living. So I was writing the soap, and I had to use those techniques on most days to get started. But once you get started, once you get the car going, the car is going.
And also maybe the collaborative process of having all those other people when you're doing television, you're not alone.
No, you are alone on soap opera writing 90% of the time.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, what happens is there are a certain number of group meetings where you all make certain that you're coordinating your script with somebody else's script. But basically, I sat in an office at ABC alone from 9 in the morning till 5 at night, and did very little except write and rewrite. I had been brought in to be the staff rewriter, so everything that came in, the producer wrote notes about what she did or didn't like, and she had a very heavy pencil, and she basically hated half the stuff that came in, so every day I had to write about half an hour's worth of material to rewrite what she wanted to have rewritten. I think quite a lot of the stuff that she didn't like was quite good anyway, but she was my boss, and if she wanted it rewritten, I would rewrite it.
Why are you not still doing it? I mean, it sounds like a very tough job, but also an ideal job for a writer because it's creative and it's a steady paycheck, television money.
Every time another producer comes in and every time another head writer comes in, there's a broom comes in and cleans the old people out, and they bring in their friends, and there's a new staff. And You know, that that just inevitably happens. And unless you're going to really spend a lot of time campaigning to try to stay in that world, writing soap opera was fun, but as other projects came along, sometimes more lucrative projects, there didn't seem to be any point in campaigning to try to get back into that world. I wrote a screenplay for Dustin Hoffman's company. At one point, a well-known comic asked me to take time off and go and work with him for several weeks, creating a one-man show for him.
Oh, who was that?
Well, since he ended up paying me but not taking much of my advice, I'm not going to tell you. I wrote a substantially new one-man show. He said, "That's really good. That's really brilliant. It's too serious." And he went back to doing what he was doing anyway. He paid me everything that he owed me.
Huh.
You know, he said, "You gave me exactly what I wanted, and now I realize I don't want it."
Hey, he was under no obligation.
Under no obligation, but it was swell because the money came in and it paid off my my credit card and paid my taxes that year, and it also paid up what I still had to pay towards my son's college education. So it was also 10 days worth of work that wiped out my debt.
Wow.
You know, I think what I wrote for him was very good, and I'm sorry that it will never see the light of day. On the other hand, how often do you get to wipe out your debt in 10 days?
So, but that is the thing about trying to be a full-time writer, feed the family. I mean, I guess your son's out of college at this point.
Yeah.
And are you married again? Or are you?
No, I've been with the same lady now for about 15 years.
Cool.
After my wife decided she wanted to go elsewhere, I had the good luck to meet somebody else, and she and I have been together for 15 years.
Are you cohabiting, or just, you know?
Mostly personal questions.
Weekending?
But,
oh, come on.
But yes, we are sharing a space, and...
Sin!
Oh, please. Yes, that's absolutely it. But what it means is that because I'm not married to her, it means that her grandchildren cannot call me Gramps.
Good.
You know, they can call me Weird Uncle Jeff, but they cannot call me Gramps. Except if I married her, then they would be able to call me Grandpa.
You know, it's probably better that they don't call you Weird Uncle Jeff in this particular political climate. That would just not be so
good.
Well,
I don't mind being called Uncle Jeff. You know?
Right.
You know, that's just fine by me. Hi, this is Jeffrey Sweet. I'm a playwright, author of The Value of Names, and Something Was Wonderful Right Away, and I'm here on Days Gone By on WGBB.
So what else are you working on right now? I mean, aside from the plays you've already written that are being done in different...
Well, I've got a new play opening in Chicago in February called Court Martial at Fort Devens, which is a historical play based on a sensational story I stumbled upon about... some black privates, some women, some WACs, it's Women's Army Corps, who got to a big fight with a racist colonel, and they won. They beat him in 1945.
Wow.
And it's an extraordinary story, and I managed to get my hands on the court-martial transcript and got my hands on primary sources that nobody had looked at in 50 years. People think that the civil rights movement really became active and that people really started to fight in the 50s. They think that it began with Rosa Parks. But these young women took on this colonel in 1945 and they beat him. They were court-martialed. They were initially convicted, but the conviction was overturned on a technicality, and when they went back to the fort expecting to have to face this colonel again, the Army had been so embarrassed about what had been revealed about the colonel's behavior during the course of the trial that the Army forced the colonel to retire.
Wow.
And there's an enormous amount of fascinating stuff in there, and I was just thrilled by the stuff I found. There's some of the passages are straight out of the court-martial transcript that you just couldn't invent.
Well, let me ask also, I mean, between that play and The Value of Names, which has The Blacklist as its background, then you had American Enterprise,
which is
about Pullman?
Yeah, it was my big labor play about 1894, yeah.
History seems to be...
Well, I alternate between personal plays and historical or political plays, because I just like to mix up the diet. I like seeing a variety of plays, and I also work on musicals.
Oh, right, yeah.
So I like to write what my tastes are, and my tastes aren't only historical or only political or only personal or only musicals. I like a mixed diet, just as a theater goer, so I'm going to write whatever story captures my interest in whatever form the story demands.
Actually, let me go back to a question that I asked early on but didn't really follow up with. Do you work on, do you have several deadlines pending at once, and during the course of, say, a day or a week, how do you map out your time so that you get your stuff done and you're not just concentrating on the business aspects or the traveling or the teaching, but you're actually writing?
Well, the teaching is the most consistent bread. You know, that's where the money comes in most regularly. So everything gets folded around the teaching gigs, which are frequently established months in advance. It depends on whether I'm working on a project on spec, that is something that I just want to do myself that I will then go off and market, or whether I'm working on a project that somebody's invited me into. I'm working on what may turn out to be a very big Broadway musical. With very well-known names, I'm not at liberty to.
Oh, come on, just a hint, something.
I can't tell you anything except they've won. One of them's won the Tony, and both of them have won Oscars.
The Bergmans?
I'm not going to tell you.
All right, okay.
They had a project that they were stuck on, and their producer saw a play of mine in Chicago last year and invited me out to lunch and started asking me sort of vague questions about how I would address this dramatic situation or that dramatic situation, and I said something that made him say, you want to look at this material, see what ideas you have. And so I looked at the material, and I had a very clear idea very quickly how to solve their problem. They'd been stalled on it for 8 or 10 years.
8 or 10 years?
Yeah, this is a project they've been working on forever that was very important to both of them, but they had not been able to lick the story.
You know, Adolph Green's dead, so it can't be him.
It will avail you not to yes. But anyway, it was. I came up with something, and both of these people said, that's it. Come join us. You're now co-author of the book.
So got me Hamlish. Hamlish is in there somewhere.
I'm not going to say.
Okay.
Anyway, so I find myself now co-authoring the book, and these guys are guys whose work I admire, so it's very flattering to be working with them. It's also very funny to visit their lavish homes,
because
I prowl around my one bedroom apartment, they could put my apartment in their kitchens.
Well, if you have a big hit musical, that means you could get a 1.5-bedroom apartment in New York.
That would be very exciting, yeah. Or even possibly a separate studio that I could use as an office, and I could get all this crap out of here, and my girlfriend would be a lot happier.
Do you still see most of the Broadway and off-Broadway shows?
Well, I see all the Broadway shows because I'm on the Council of the Dramatists Guild, which makes me a Tony voter.
Oh, cool.
So I see all the Broadway shows. I get to see a reasonable amount of off-Broadway as well. And I'm also writing a blog for Backstage's online.
Cool.
So between all of these different affiliations, I usually can get in to see whatever I want to see, and I see a fair amount of stuff.
Well, as a Tony voter,
yeah,
what you voting for this year?
I have to tell you that in my opinion, this has been a kind of a doggy year.
Okay.
You know, when you think like last year, we had 4 really viable musicals for Best Musical. You know, there were 4 shows that are still running.
Yeah.
You know, we had 4 musicals that were hits in one season. Wow, we hadn't had anything like that since the early 60s.
And they were pretty much worthy hits. I mean, Spamalot, yeah. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels is delightful.
Yeah.
Spelling Bee, what was the fourth?
And Light and the Piazza.
Well, okay.
You know, and all 4 of them are hits. And it was delightful, and they all had their own particular strengths, but you had to parse out which you thought had a better score and which you thought had a better book and which was overall a better production and so forth. But it was really a contest.
But this year, actually, we have 4 musicals that may be commercial hits, if not critical ones. If you think about the 4 that are nominated, there's a possibility there.
Yeah. I mean, Jersey Boys is going to make its money back, obviously.
Drowsy Chaperone is selling well because the critics loved it. And Color Purple is selling well because of Oprah.
Yeah, so you've got possibly 3 hits there, and I wouldn't be surprised if Wedding Singer ekes through as well because it makes its... It makes its audience happy. My theory is that Wedding Singer is the show that you go to see if you can't get into Jersey Boys. mm-hmm. both celebrations of Jersey culture.
And if you're coming through the tunnel, you know, on the weekend with your parents, that's, yeah. But you sound less excited about that crop.
I'm not terribly happy about the scores of any of them. I'm sitting there, there's some lyrics that I like in Drowsy Chaperone, but I'm not nuts about the music in that, and I'm not, of course, Jersey Boys doesn't have an original score,
right.
So they've nominated the Andrew Lloyd Webber, David Zippel score for Woman in White. I was disappointed in that. I wanted to like it more. But
I don't think there is a score this year that's really knocked anybody. I mean, as much as people, and I had a great time at Drowsy Chaperone, I can't say that I came out of there like from an Irving Berlin musical going, oh yeah, you know, the score is just part and parcel. You know,
it's a very good extended review sketch. Bob Martin is from the Toronto company of Second City, and since I'm a big Second City fan, I'm delighted for that. And he also co-wrote a TV series I love called Slings and Arrows, which is the best series I've ever seen about the theater, which is a parody of the Stratford Festival up in Ontario. They've been running it on the Sundance Channel, and very, very funny show.
Oh wow! Okay.
So I'm a fan of his. And I'm a fan of the show, The Drowsy Chaperone, but on some level I'm a little disappointed because this should have been an engaging also-ran. It should not be, you know, the favorite. This is a show that's like so many shows that have been nominated or won in the past few years, makes fun of musicals. And we've had so many musicals that make fun of musicals over the past few years, and not very many really good original musicals, you know, musicals that take themselves seriously. One of the things that was pleasing about Light in the Piazza was that it didn't mock the form. Spamalot mocked the form, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels mocked the form, Spelling Bee mocked the form.
Yeah. Avenue Q mocks as well, yeah.
Sorry?
Avenue Q as well.
Avenue Q, absolutely.
Yeah.
And You're in Town, and, you know, musical's a musical.
Now, most of these musicals I really liked, I mean, I have to say. But
I think You're in Town has got a pretty tough underneath. It's actually saying something very seriously political, and that show is really much tougher than an affectionate parody of musicals. It's about how we distract ourselves with amusements and pay no attention, and we are under the illusion that because we support the right culture that we're doing something.
Right.
You know, so there's underneath it. It's actually a rather tough show with some. Unpleasant things. You know, we people who've seen the show forget that, yes, the corporate bad guys, you know, die, but in the epilogue we discover that
nobody has enough fresh water.
Well, not only that, she dies too. So there's precious little comfort in there for anybody of any political persuasion in that show. It's a very tough little show.
Well, I mean, at the very end, the lead character holds up a book of Malthus and says, read this. I mean, that's Brecht right there.
Malthus, yes.
Well, we have only very, very little time left, unfortunately, so I want to ask very quickly about the plays of this year, both Broadway and off, and your thoughts.
I will end up voting for History Boys because it's consistently witty and entertaining, and I, God knows I enjoyed it, and I've been following the guys from Beyond the Fringe ever since those days. I'm not over the moon about the play because I don't quite believe it. I enjoyed it, but I don't quite believe it. I don't believe that because this guy comes in that he all of a sudden turns everything around in the school because they succumb to his cynicism.
For me, the plays were actually weaker than the musicals. And some I like Rabbit Hole though.
Well, I liked most of Rabbit Hole. I thought that it repeated its effects a little bit. I would have cut the first scene in the second act and taken out the intermission and played it as a 90-minute one act. And I think that's just my sort of meatball surgery. But every scene was about the ghost of the kid in the room and how it was affecting everybody. And you know, how many times can you say we're devastated, we're devastated, we're devastated, or dramatize that? That said, I liked it a lot. I just was.
I mean, you know, God forbid you should ever have to get over the loss of that's what life is for a couple of years.
Absolutely.
After you, everything is
the kid
in the room.
The needs of drama are different than the needs of life. It's It took all evening to do what Shakespeare did brilliantly with one speech in King John, when Constance talks about grief walking up and down with her in the corridors, death of her son. But I still think it was a darn good play, and I was glad it was on this season. Actually, the play that I was surprised by, because I didn't expect to care much for it at all, was Festin, which I saw late in its run.
Ooh.
And maybe when it opened, they had found their ensemble. But 4 weeks in, when I saw it, I thought it was just riveting, and I thought that the performances were sensational. I thought that Larry Brigman was absolutely cheated of the nomination he should have gotten. I thought that Michael Hayden was about as good as I've ever seen him. I thought that people absolutely misunderstood what Ally McGraw had been directed to do. They say that she was giving an unconvincing performance. She's playing the part of a woman who's trying to ignore the fact that she's been living with a monster for 30 years and has done nothing about it. So the artificiality is the part. So I sat there with a friend of mine, and we were both dumbstruck by what impact it had on us. My agent, who teaches at a university, sent some of her students to see it, and they all came back, and that was their favorite show of the season. So I think it got kind of a bum's rush. I think it's a much more interesting play, and I certainly would have put it up if I'd been on the nominating committee. That would have been one of the ones that I nominated over.
Over Will or whatever else.
Yeah, Will, which is
that's a Lisa Kron play about her mom,
yeah,
or sort of about her mom, meta theatrically.
Yeah, which I
as she says 10,000 times
of it, but. Yeah. But I thought that the best parts of it were indeed the mom, and that the other stuff would tend to be either clumsy or a little cute. And The Lieutenant of Inishmore, I thought it was just wonderfully crafted, but it made something beautifully that I just didn't care for.
Hmm.
I think that this is a Martin McDonagh, his guiding aesthetic is, what can I do to get at the audience? How can I make them squirm, or how can I make them... and he's done this in play after play after play. And I find that slightly juvenile.
Well, when he was writing these things, he was in his early 20s.
Yeah, I know, and this is very obviously sort of, okay, I'm going to try to do on stage what Quentin Tarantino did in Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
Just as Lonesome West was... his response to True West and American Buffalo. And on some level, you know, as well done and as well crafted as it is, and I think Inishmore, on some level, is one of the best crafted plays he's done. The mock disemboweled the people on stage and all the blood packs that had exploded and all the rest of it. I thought that really he ultimately was not making a point so much as jolting the bejesus out of the audience. I felt very similar about The Pillow Man, although The Pillow Man I found actively distasteful.
You know,
I thought it pretended to be about something and really was only about getting a rise out of the audience. I know a lot of people who don't agree with that, and that's fine. That's why we have conversations. But I'm not a part of his...
Okay.
But, you know, sometimes writers develop. I remember that in the early days that Richard Greenberg's plays were very superficially clever and glib, and I was not a big fan. And then he wrote Eastern Standard, and that seemed to signal a transition. And then after that, he wrote four or five plays that I just think are glorious, you know, culminating in Take Me Out. So I'm, even when he doesn't succeed... I'm always eager to go to see another Greenberg play because between that and The American Plan and a few of his other plays, some of those plays are just gorgeous.
Well, that was the surprising thing about Rabbit Hole from David Lindsay of Bear. I mean, his other plays were these kind of audience-begging, goofy, weird, sort of sick trailer trash fantasy things, right, where his trademark was becoming...
outrageous thing can I do now?
Yeah,
and I think that represents an advance for him. It was like
it was a leap.
Nikki Silver had a play. It was done at the Vineyard, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was a real revelation from him. It was such a break in what he had done before. It got creamed by the critics, but I went with a friend who joined me reluctantly because she was not a Nikki Silva fan either. And at the intermission, we looked at each other and said, am I nuts or is this really good?
Hmm.
And we were, you know, tremendously impressed by it, tremendously moved by it. What he'd suddenly done was found a point of empathetic contact with his own characters. Rather than making fun of people's pain and downfall and embarrassments, he actually, you got a feeling that he cared about the characters for the first time. The wisdom had suddenly arrived. And that once wisdom arrives, you never go back to writing juvenile stuff. You know, easy jokes about people's infirmities.
I still like easy jokes about infirmities, so I still have that juvenile streak, but I'm thrilled. Jeffrey Sweet has been with us sharing his wisdom and his theater experience, and I want to wish you best of luck with all your projects. Please remind folks again about the George Street Value of Names, when and where and what.
Well, that'll be coming in November. It's called The Value of Names. Jack Klugman is starring in it. We're hoping to get somebody very good to play opposite him. We've got some tantalizing prospects, but I've been warned not to say anything about them.
Maybe you can actually get Ben Gazzara. Then you can have two people on stage going, hello.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. How are you doing? That'd be pretty fun to hear.
And there's a man I'm directing, With and Without, which is an old play of mine that's going to be opening at Blueberry Pond, which is a little theater in Westchester. This is the first time I'm directing a full production of one of my own plays.
Oh, wow.
It's an older play, but in the middle of beginning preparation for this, I got word from a producer in London who's taken an option on it and may open it in the West End in November.
Nice.
So I'll believe it when I see it, but all of a sudden, you know, this play, which I wrote 10, 11 years ago, is rising from the dead again.
Well, that's the wonderful thing. You know, you can do a play, it can do well or flop or somewhere in the middle, and then a few years later, it's there, it's on paper, it's
years
still
there. Years ago, I interviewed
there.
Richard Rodgers. And when I interviewed Richard Rodgers, he had just had a new show open, which was struggling, but he had also recently gone to Goodspeed to see a show that he had written when he was in his early 20s. And I asked him, gee, what does that feel like, you know, go see something of yours that you wrote when you were, you know, that age? And he says, they call it a revival, and I feel revived.
That's great. That's great. And it has been revivifying to talk with you, Jeff Sweet, about the theater. It's great. I wish you all the best of luck.
Well, thank you for inviting me. My pleasure.